People living in many rooms, we must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. What are our primary needs as human beings? Things that will keep us alive, of course. Those are the primary needs. Without them, we will cease to exist. And that is pretty much, number one, our food. Number two, our water, eating and drinking. And number three would be reproduction. And, of course, reproduction for the sake of bringing about a next generation, not for the sake of him or her, their life being dependent on reproduction, no. But for the sake of having a next generation, reproduction is also a primary need. And there are secondary needs. These secondary needs are things that you need to have. But if you don't have them, or if you don't have them in certain ways, then it won't be the end of your life, literally saying. And then, of course, there are the pseudo needs, which are things that you know you think you need, but in reality, you don't. When it comes to something like a necessary need, a primary need that we would also need to have as human beings, is the need for shelter. Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, "Inna lil dari sharafan," that a house has honor. "Wa sharafuha as-sahatul wasi'a," and one of the things that brings about an honorable house is a large yard, as-sahatul wasi'a. "Wal khulata as-salihin," and righteous associates, righteous people that you mix with, that you mingle with, that you gather with. Which means your circle of friends, of course, you are going to be inviting to your house, need to be righteous and noble and good. وَإِنَّ لَهَا بَرَكَةً وَبَرَكَتُهَا جَوْدَةُ مَوْضِعِهَا. And a house also has barakah as well. And among the barakah that a house has is the barakah of where it's placed, where the house is situated. وَسَعَةُ سَاحَتِهَا, and again, how large the yard is. وَحُسْنُ جِوَارِ جِيرَانِهَا, and how noble, how good the neighbors are as well. Now, when it does come to remembering that we, of course, when we're buying a house, we need to remember that we have things that we need to take care of, as far as slaughtering an animal, as far as being thankful, as far as honoring our neighbors, as far as making sure that this the place or the situation of the house, its location is good. It's also very important for us to remember Islamically that we need to keep the house clean. We need to make sure that if the house needs renovation, it is renovated. You know, there are a variety of ahadith here that have been mentioned by Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli that speak about making sure that you don't live in a house that has problems, that has defects in it, without, and you neglecting to fix it as well. Rasulullah, he says, ثَلَاثَةً لَا يُحِبُّهُمْ رَبُّكَ. There are three that God, your Lord, does not like. And one of them is رَجُلٌ نَزَلَ بَيْتًا خَرِبًا. That one of them is a man who lives in a house that is ruined, that is destroyed, that has defects, that has problems in it. And then there are hadith that say that this is maskana to shaitan, and other hadith that say that you need to make sure that the cleanest place in your house is mawdi'ul wudu, or the place where you do your wudu, wa nadhafatu mutawaddah, as the hadith says from Imam al-Sadiq salamullahi alayhi. And of course, remembering that everything needs to be as clean as possible.
Ayatollah Javadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Al-shu'um fi thalatha, there are three wretchedness or wickedness. Wretchedness is in three things. Number one, wa'amma al-dar fadhiqu sahatiha, as for a house, if the yard is too small. وَشَرُّ جِيرَانِهَا, and the neighbors being bad. وَكَثْرَةُ عُيُوبِهَا, and there being too many faults in the house. Of course, we want to benefit in the best possible way from the house, from the place that you are living in, and remembering that these are from among the ni'mas of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that you live in a nice place, that of course, as we said, that you have a good, comfortable, fast means of transport, if we could say. And of course, all of that will complement in the best form when there is a stable household, when you have a righteous wife who is of course managing all of these affairs with you. You need to remember that, you know, there's an issue of observing of zaman and makan, time and place when it comes to these things. Just because, you know, this is an interesting hadith from Imam Rida, salamullahi alayhi, just because, you know, your father or your grandfather was living in a very small, very tight kind of tight-knitted house, doesn't necessarily need to mean that you need to be in the exact same place. You know, you could go out to the outskirts of the city and you can have a larger house, a wider house, a more comfortable house, and things like that. Inna Abul Hasan alayhi salam, Imam Ridda salamullahi alayhi, ishtara daran wa amara mawlan lahu an yatahawwal ilayha. Imam Ridda salamullahi alayhi purchased a house and he then asked his servant to come and live with him. Wa qal, إن منزلك ضيق. He said to the servant, your house is very small. فقال قد أحدث هذه الدار أبي. And then the servant said to Imam Rida, it is my father who purchased or who bought or who made this particular house. فقال أبو الحسن, and أبو الحسن, Imam الرضا سلام الله عليه, said to him, إن كان أبوك أحمق ينبغي أن تكون مثله. If your father was, for example, foolish, if your father was ignorant, if your father didn't know better, does it mean that you need to be exactly the same? It certainly meant in this particular understanding that he didn't know if they were, if he was, someone who didn't know, someone who was illiterate, someone who was, as Ayatollah Jawadi says, nadan. You know, you didn't know better. Does that mean you need to be exactly the same thing? These are just among the things that one needs to observe as far as the ni'mas, the blessings when it comes to a house. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams, hear the children scream.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind, a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor. Now we kick things off here because positive vaccine sentiment in Britain, well, it's gone up by more than 90% since the start of the year. But as Saeed Poreza reports, a combination of conspiracy theories, the lack of trust in the government and the healthcare system has led certain British communities to think twice about taking the jab.
The Beit al-Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us, and they said with the idea of a pop-up clinic here, vaccination clinic, and you know, we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online, videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claims silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been those questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not. But those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country. And they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. mostly over fears it might contain pork. Or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Puriza, London.
Well, Dr. Bob Gill, who's the producer of The Great NHS Heist and, of course, a practicing family GP. Now, why has the take-up been so low, Dr. Gill? I mean, we've heard some of the reasons here, but how are you finding it from your perspective?
Well, generally, my patients are very welcome. The vaccine, if we hear there's any hesitation amongst high-risk groups, then we will take the time to speak to individual patients and reassure them that the vaccine is safe. All my staff who are eligible have had the vaccine. I have had the vaccine. My wife's had the vaccine. And often when they hear these personal accounts and reassurance from a trusted health professional, that often helps get over the hesitation.
Now, one of the major issues here is the misinformation being promoted online. How can that be combated?
It's very difficult. You know, it doesn't take long for lies to spread very widely, and often there may even be an element grain of truth, but things get amplified out of all proportion, and they pick up on individuals' mistrust of government, as your report very clearly outlined. And you know, we do know society is not equal. There is discrimination out there in society, particularly, you know, with the hostile environment and how poor immigrant populations have been treated in recent years. So that trust has been eroded by government policy. But when it comes to healthcare, in particular, the uptake in the vaccination program, we have to undo some of that damage, which has been, you know, well-founded in terms of trust in government.
Now, we're hearing several reports that there are different European countries that are seriously considering implementing the vaccine passports for those who are thinking of international travel, of holidays, and so on. Do moves like this help or hinder the pro-vaccine message?
I think, in a way, governments may be using this as a stick in terms of limiting people's freedom to travel. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. If you introduce some sort of passport system for vaccination, well, that may also indicate the thin edge of the wedge. You may start to introduce other health information which people would rather be kept private. And there is that argument that this might lead to creeping expansion of the amount of information we have to provide to travel. So I'm reluctant to support the passport idea, just because we don't know where this might end up. But I think we need to use every positive means to encourage people to take up the vaccine.
Dr. Bob Gill, thank you, as always. Now, we stay here in the United Kingdom, where we begin with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who joined more than 20 other world leaders in calling for a new global treaty to help the world prepare for any future pandemics. In a joint letter published today in newspapers around the world, the leaders argued that the COVID-19 crisis had posed the greatest challenge for the global community since the late 1940s. In the letter, the leaders expressed hope that any future treaty would provide a more robust international health architecture that provides better protection for future generations. The document was signed by 24 signatories, including the head of the World Health Organization, in addition to leaders from across Europe, Asia, and Africa. The United Nations is urging international donors to pledge up to $10 billion to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria, adding that the need for humanitarian support in the country has never been greater. The appeal comes on the same day as Tuesday's Brussels Conference on Syria, an annual event co-hosted by the UN and the European Union. Ahead of the event, UN aid chief Mark Lowcock stated that plummeting living conditions, economic decline and COVID-19 have resulted in more hunger, malnutrition and disease. Earlier this month, Syria marked its grim 10-year anniversary of the war. The foreign-backed conflict in Syria, which flared up in 2011, has so far claimed the lives of 500,000 people and has left millions more displaced.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert, in Lakesh, we know that Riyadh is very keen to launder its reputation. We heard about sports washing, but this time using the environment in what some are calling a little bit of greenwashing. Tell me more.
Well, this is an interesting story. Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is pledging that 10 billion trees will be planted in Saudi Arabia in a bid to tackle climate change. And on top of that as well, this factors into the 2030 plan that they put forth, which, of course, is supposed to gear Saudi Arabia to essentially move away from its dependency upon oil purely. But from the kingdom, what we have seen is that in an attempt to try and distract people, and specifically its critics, they have attempted to, like you said, sports wash and use things like this, now an environmental cause, in order to try and take attention away from the real issues inside of their kingdom. Namely, in this case, if we're talking about climate change, it's interesting that they're currently bombarding Yemen, and the airstrikes have only gone up since the U.S. Biden administration has came into power. That's not going to be good for the environment, yet we're seeing that these pieces are distributed. Even this piece that we pulled up was on The Independent. They're putting it out in, of course, a way which makes Saudi Arabia look good. When people see these headlines, people think that Saudi Arabia is moving towards progress, but that is not what we're seeing with Saudi Arabia. In fact, we're seeing that things like beheadings are on the rise, and of course, its bombardment and genocide, as it's been termed, inside of Yemen is only escalating.
Now, with some of the comments you mentioned there, is that being reflected online, Rob?
Well, the first comment we've got here, and an immediate reaction to this when the story came out, in fact, is from a Twitter user who says, make sure to name the forest Jamal Khashoggi. This guy is a criminal and dictator with innocent blood on his hands. We've got another one here as well who says, how does someone acquire 10 billion trees? More like 10 billion lies.
Right, we'll leave that there. And we move to another story where you touch very briefly upon perhaps the impact of the Biden administration here in not stopping the situation in Yemen. Syria's now come up. What is Mr. Blinken, the new Secretary of State, saying?
Well, the Secretary of State hosted a meeting, a virtual meeting in the United Nations Security Council yesterday. And he sort of emerged as a heroic figure from it, at least if you were to read the Western press, that's how it's being portrayed, as he's calling for the opening of more humanitarian aid corridors and the upping of aid into Syria. You know, it just so happens that the humanitarian king, Antony Blinken, is calling for the aid corridors, which lead directly into northeastern Syria, to be opened most urgently. And that's where the United States just so happens to have a few hundred of its forces, and of course, its allies, the Kurdish SDF, operating and holds the country. And of course, it is the United States, and Antony Blinken was part of this in the Obama administration, that helped start this war, backing al-Qaeda-linked groups. And of course, in this meeting as well, we saw a lot of attention on northwestern Syria, which is controlled by a group, primarily this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And they are an offshoot, essentially the name has just changed, of Shabat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, essentially. Whilst this was ongoing, and we saw a lot of talk about the humanitarian situation in Syria. We saw relatively no talk whatsoever about the sanctions regime, that's the Caesar Act. They said over the past year, the humanitarian situation has grown in extremely dire. It's got a lot worse. But it was last year, in fact, in June, when the Caesar Act was first put into action. And so it's only natural that this has happened in the country. And yet we're not hearing anything. In fact, it was only the Syrian and Russian representatives in the Security Council that even mentioned the sanctions.
Indeed, you wouldn't be at all suggesting that the two things are linked, would you, Robert? I mean, perish the thought. Quick trawl through social media, please.
The first reaction we have here states that the United States waged a decade-long proxy war against Syria, is occupying large swathes of its territory, stealing its oil, wheat supplies, and imposing sanctions so severe millions of Syrians are going hungry. And this piece of garbage has the goal to talk about humanitarian aid. It's depraved. We've got another one here as well, another strong response from Todd, who says, when Syria refused to have the pipeline bisect their nation, the United States organized and funded terrorists and imposed sanctions. Humanitarian aid does not come with strings nor conditions. Humanitarians do not impose complicity with siege warfare.
All right, strong words to leave it on. Robert Inakesh, thank you. Now, pious Muslim women across Europe are finding life more difficult amid growing Islamophobia. Switzerland became the most recent country to ban the niqab on the continent, forcing Muslim women to give up a key aspect of their faith by force. Now, what impact does this state-backed anti-Islam law have on women's lives? Well, Robert Carter followed up the story and filed this report.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticised burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you. I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal. So it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great. Yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere. The defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve.
The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
France's foreign minister has cranked up further pressure on Lebanese leaders to form a working government, urging them in personal phone calls for an immediate halt to what he called deliberate obstruction. Early in the week, Jean-Yves Le Drian called the Lebanese President Michel Aoun, Acting Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and Parliamentary Speaker Nabih Berri, and called for an end to the 7 months of political deadlock that's driven the country toward collapse. The latest rounds of talks between Aoun and Hariri collapsed last week. Disagreements over the shape and size of a new cabinet continue to block any progress. Lebanon is currently facing its worst economic crisis in modern history, a situation exacerbated by pandemic restrictions and last year's explosion at Beirut's port. It's the event that reignited the Black Lives Matter movement last summer in the U.S. and across the globe. Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who knelt on the body of African-American George Floyd, is finally in the docks with the eyes of the world on his every move, on his every statement. Richard Sudan's been closely following this one online. It's disturbing already, Richard.
And it's disturbing many people around the world who are keeping an eye on proceedings, having seen the event take place in May of last year. Now, there's been massive protests taking place outside the courthouse where proceedings are happening. And on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, we've seen some very emotional and graphic testimony from witnesses that have been called to the stand. Now, we've heard one testimony from one witness named Donald Williams, who talked about the life draining away from George Floyd's eyes, the life visibly draining away from his face as Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. And he talked about the fact that George Floyd was quite clearly not resisting arrest. And this witness flatly referred to the actions of Derek Chauvin as murder, which of course chimes and resonates with how most people around the world really saw this event transpire. We saw another witness talk about the fact that viewing the footage of the incident taking place in real time, that Derek Chauvin knelt on the neck of George Floyd for so long that she actually thought the video footage had actually frozen. The scenes were that serious. And actually, one of the things which is really catching people's attention and which people are incredulous about is the fact that the defense is arguing that Derek Chauvin used reasonable force and was following police protocol and procedures. Vast, you know, millions of people around the world really don't view it this way, Amina. Derek Chauvin is facing two counts of murder, one count of manslaughter, and people are already skeptical about whether or not they'll see a conviction. And of course, the actual reality in the United States, I'm afraid for many people, is that even if Derek Chauvin goes to prison, for there to be a real precedent set, which would actually see systemic change in the United States, there are numbers and there are many, many police officers, critics would say, that simply need to be jailed for the killing of black people while they wear police uniforms. Amina, so the whole world is watching this trial, and we've seen very emotional testimonies indeed.
Social media for us. Can you choose your favorite two tweets on this topic for me, Richard?
Let's go first to Bishop Talbot Swan, who says, which one of you who are swearing that Derek Chauvin's actions had nothing to do with George Floyd's death are willing to lay handcuffed on the ground and allow a grown man to kneel on your neck with his full weight for 9 minutes to demonstrate how harmless that is? I'll wait. And we have a reaction also from Daniel, who says, if they don't do the right thing in the Derek Chauvin trial, it seems reasonable to expect that major response activities will take place. George Floyd was absolutely intentionally murdered. Floyd mattered and still does. And thousands upon thousands of other victims do too.
All right, we'll move on to another story, controversial for different reasons, Richard.
Indeed. So Ghislaine Maxwell, the confidant, partner, and some would say collaborator with Jeffrey Epstein, is facing sex trafficking charges. Now, of course, Jeffrey Epstein was accused of running perhaps most the wide-reaching and elaborate abuse ring possibly in history, many people are saying. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell was a key figure in that. Now, she's facing charges. We'll see where this goes. Of course, Epstein actually died in New York Correctional Facility in the summer of 2019. The official reason was, of course, suicide. But many people actually say that he was murdered in order to prevent him testifying and releasing information on a lot of people. And some people would say Prince Andrew is one of the people that potentially would have had the lid lifted on his activities. And so, of course, this trial and these charges are about Ghislaine Maxwell, but really this is about the number of people that were potentially implicated in this abuse ring ran by Jeffrey Epstein. And actually, I mean, some people say that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were Israeli spies. That's what a lot of people online are certainly saying. So, you know, this kind of move is welcome, if you like. But I'm afraid for a lot of people, the fact that Jeffrey Epstein will never take the stand will probably, some might say, mean that many other people potentially implicated in this massive, massive crime will never face full accountability for their actions. Of course, Prince Andrew was famously pictured with Virginia Giuffre, who was allegedly trafficked with Ghislaine Maxwell, literally in the picture. And of course, the famous interview took place with Prince Andrew, where he denied virtually all of the questions that were put to him.
Despite some of that photographic evidence. Wow. Richard Sedan, thank you. And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, the state of heart. What will save us on the day of judgment? Are we favored based on our race or color? No. Then what is it? It is the place in our body which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala made the location of the most valuable possession of a human being, which is iman, faith, and that place is your heart. What favors you in the sight of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the state of your heart. What will save you on the day of judgment is qalbun salim, a sound heart. The state of your heart will decide what you do with your knowledge. Will you benefit from it by practicing it or not? For example, if you hear a verse of Quran or a hadith, does it make you feel you want to practice it straight away, or does it not have much impact on you? Whatever the answer is, it will tell you about the state of your heart. For those whose state of the heart is clean and pure, as soon as they listen to an admonishment of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, of Prophet of Allah, or Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, or they, you know, recite a verse of Quran or read a hadith or a narration in a hadith book, the state of their heart is actually what triggers them to act on that. If the state of heart is filthy and it's darkened, then rest assured this person, number one, is not going to be interested in listening to this. And secondly, even if he gets to listen to this admonishment, he is not going to pay any attention. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the state of heart and how important it is. And we said that if somebody's state of heart is solid, it's pure, it's clean, it's transparent, then this person is going to be welcoming of the admonishments and of the commands of Allah, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. But if this person sins or sins too much and his heart has become darkened, this person is not going to be receptive towards the admonishments of Allah, Prophet, and Ahlul Bayt. Sins have an effect on your heart. Know this. They can cause your heart to be sealed so that the light of knowledge and guidance doesn't reach it anymore. And the verses of Quran don't affect this person anymore. May Allah Azza wa Jal protect us from this. Once our hearts get sealed, then there is no power that can provide us any guidance. There are many diseases we find in our hearts, like envy, hasad, greed, lust, and showing off. Our aim should be to strive to purify our hearts and turn back to Allah with a sound heart. Again, remember, qalbun salim, a sound heart. Once a wise man made this dua, O Allah, purify my heart from anything but you. Because we know that the height of purity, the height of cleanliness, the height of that chastity is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. There's no one more purer than Him. So if Allah is the only one residing in our hearts, of course our hearts are going to be filled with guidance and knowledge. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight.
Photos of children packed into makeshift detention centers highlight the need for press access to such centers so people can see the inhumanity in U.S. migration policy, says Jessica Corbett Ryder in an article published under the heading, As Biden Restricts Media Access, Photos Show Children in Crowded Border Jails. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The release of photos from inside a U.S. detention facility is boosting alarm about the Biden administration's response to an influx of migrants, particularly unaccompanied children who aren't being deported under a public health law, and its refusal to allow reporters access to what one journalist called border jails. Representative Henry Kohler shared the photos taken over the weekend at a U.S. Customs and Border Protection CBP overflow facility in Donna, Texas, with Axios, who noted recently that they reveal the crowded makeshift conditions at a border as the government's long-term child shelters and family detention centers fill up. Seller, who did not tour the facility or take the photos, said the setting is terrible conditions for the children. And although U.S. Border Patrol agents are doing the best they can under the circumstances, they're not equipped to care for kids and need help from the administration. He called for minors to be quickly transferred to the relevant Department of Health and Human Services office. CBP, a Department of Homeland Security DHS agency, is supposed to transfer most unaccompanied children to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, ORR, within 72 hours. However, thousands of minors have recently been held past that legal limit. According to a DHS document leaked to Axios, 3,314 children had been in custody longer than 3 days, 2,226 more than 5 days, and 823 over 10 days. Advocates, including Dennis Bell, Amnesty International USA's researcher for refugee and migrant rights, have also stressed that detaining unaccompanied children in ORR facilities cannot become status quo because kids need a place to call home, and pushed for placing minors with families, friends, and community members in the U.S. Appearing on the review, NBC News and MSNBC correspondent Jacob Sobroff, author of Separated, Inside an American Tragedy, a book on former President Donald Trump's immigration policies, first addressed the Axios reporting, saying, "Those are horrific photos. Those are the circumstances I think all of us who follow this closely sort of knew that the children were in. Part of the problem is the Biden administration isn't letting us in to go to see them for ourselves. These are border patrol facilities, just like the Trump administration used during separation," Sobroff explained. "That's not the facility I was in where they caged the children. That facility is closed for renovations, believe it or not, under a congressional appropriations bill. But this is the same type of punitive jail-like facility operated by the border patrol agents who are there as law enforcement agents. They wear guns on their hip. That's what this is. The facilities themselves are the same types of facilities, and it's why it's problematic we're not able to go in and show for ourselves what it is the Biden administration says they want to change," he continued. The journalist added that denying reporters access to the facilities is a huge mistake, and he doesn't think COVID-19 is a good excuse because the visitors can wear personal protective equipment, including face masks. As Sobroff put it, "If senators can go in there with the Secretary of Homeland Security, why can't journalists?" U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was joined by two senators from each party to observe the processing, shelter, and transfer of unaccompanied children in El Paso, Texas. Among them was Senator Chris Murphy, who said he fought back tears at the CBP facility, where he observed hundreds of kids packed into big open rooms. A CBP official said the agency recently released 44 new photos and 2 videos from inside facilities in El Paso and Donna in an effort to balance the need for public transparency and accountability. But the agency also continues to discourage external visitors, including journalists, to facilities that house migrant children. Asked about media access during a briefing recently, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said that I hope to have an update in the coming days. We are working with the Department of Health and Human Services and also the Department of Homeland Security to ensure the privacy and ensure we are following COVID protocols. We remain committed to transparency and, of course, as I know that last week, we certainly want to make sure that the media has access to these sites. Echoing Mayorkas's comments in recent days, Psaki added that the photos released by Seller show that we've long been saying, which is that these border patrol facilities are not places made for children. They're not places that we want children to be staying for an extended period of time. Our alternative is to send children back on this treacherous journey. That is not, in our view, the right choice to make, unquote. Psaki also pushed back against GOP characterizations of our overcrowded facilities and delayed processing of children, saying that children presenting at our border who are fleeing violence, who are fleeing prosecution, who are fleeing terrible situations is not a crisis. We feel that it is our responsibility to humanely approach this circumstance and make sure they are treated and put into conditions that are safe, unquote. The Week's Ryan Cooper noted in a column that too many mainstream media outlets are bolstering Republicans' bad faith and xenophobic outrage by treating the current situation as a chaotic crisis, even when its origins are quite clear. According to Cooper, the most honest criticism of Biden's immigration record is that he has not reversed Trump's appalling illegal practices fast enough, nor those of his predecessor, which were nearly as bad. But fundamentally, even with this recent surge of migrants, we are not talking about that many people. There were huge flows of unauthorized immigration during the Bush administration with numbers regularly many times as large as those seen under President Trump. It's true that it would be much cheaper and simpler to deflate the frenzy of media hysteria by doing what Trump did, basically closing the border, throwing penniless refugees back over it, and forcing Mexico to deal with the problem, Cooper concluded. Dealing with migrants in a fair and humane fashion will require money, patience, and good administration. But how better to solve a fake crisis created by Republicans and border occupants of green rooms in Washington, D.C. than with a fake solution, unquote.
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016 when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy, knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side. And then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council Ali Shamkhani said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as the flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline.
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation. And could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. This stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world. And new line of calculations are going to be made for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing its signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name...